Roger sat on a stone, sewing a bright patch onto his cloak. Like his other clothes, the original cloth had long since worn away, replaced a patch at a time until only the patches remained.
Set up the circle when you're done, boy.
Eric's wineskin was nearly empty. Roger looked at the setting sun and winced, moving quickly to comply. The circle was small, only 10 feet in diameter, just big enough for two men to lie with a fire between them. Roger put a stake at the center of the camp and used a 5-foot string hooked to it to draw a smooth circle in the soil. He laid the portable circle out along its perimeter, using a straight stick to ensure that the warded plates lined up properly. But he was no warder and couldn't be sure he had done it right. When he was finished, Eric stumbled over to inspect his work.
Looks right.
Roger felt a chill on his spine and went over everything again to be sure, and a third time to be positive. Still, he was uneasy as he built a fire and prepared supper, the sun dipping ever lower. Roger had never seen a demon, at least not that he remembered clearly. The clawed hand that had burst through his parents' door was etched forever in his mind, but the rest, even the coiling that had crippled him, was only a haze of smoke and teeth and horn. His blood ran cold as the woods began to cast long shadows on the road. It wasn't long before a ghost-like form rose up out of the ground, not far from their fire. The wood demon was no bigger than an average man, with knobbed and bark-like skin stretched hard over wiry sinew. The creature saw their fire and threw back its horned head and revealed rows of sharp teeth. It flexed its claws, limbering them for killing. Other shapes flitted on the edge of the firelight, slowly surrounding them. Roger's eyes flicked to Eric, who was drawing hard on his wineskin. He had hoped that his master, who had slept in portable circles before, might be calm. But the fear in Eric's eyes said differently. With a shaking hand, Roger reached into his secret pocket and took out his talisman, gripping it tightly. The wood demon lowered its horns and charged, setting something off in Roger's mind. Suddenly, he was 3 years old, watching over his mother's shoulder as death approached. Roger gripped the talisman and felt his mother's spirit around him like a physical presence. He trusted it to protect him more than the wards as the coiling bore down on him. Gerald's web was edged in silver fire in the air for a brief instant, and the coiling was thrown back, stunned. Relief was short-lived. The sound and light drew the attention of other woodies, and they charged in turn, testing the net from all sides. But Gerald's lack of wards held fast. One by one, or in groups, the wood demons were thrown back, forced to circle angrily, searching in vain for weakness. But as the assault went on, Roger's mind wandered. Again and again, he saw his parents die, his father burned, and his mother drowning the flame demon before shoving him into the bolt hole. And over, he saw Eric shove them aside. Eric had killed his mother, as surely as if he had done the deed himself. Roger brought the talisman to his lips, kissing her red hair.
What's that you're holding?
At any other time, Roger would have felt a stab of panic at his talisman's discovery, but he was in a different place now, reliving a nightmare and desperately trying to sort out what it meant. Eric had been like a father to him for over 10 years. Could these memories really be true? He opened his hand, letting Eric see the tiny wooden doll with its bright red hair.
My mom.
Eric looked sadly at the doll, and something in his expression told Roger all he needed to know. His memory was true. Angry words came to Roger's lips, and he tensed, ready to charge his master and throw him from the circle and let the coralings have him. Eric lowered his eyes.
Come, my child, and light will find thee. Come, light of day.
The lullaby tickled Roger's memory, just as the sight of the wood demon had. Suddenly, he remembered how Eric had held him in the very circle they now sat in, singing the same lullaby as Riverbridge burned. Like his talisman, the song wrapped itself around Roger, reminding him how safe it had made him feel that night. Eric had been a coward, it was true, but he had honored Callie's request to take care of him, though it had cost him his royal commission and ruined his career. He tucked his talisman away in its secret pocket and stared out into the night as images over a decade old flashed in his mind, and he tried desperately to make sense of them. Eventually, Roger pulled himself from contemplation and fetched their cooking utensils. They fried sausages and tomatoes in a small skillet, eating them with hard, crusty bread. After supper, they practiced. Roger took out his fiddle, and Eric wet his lips with the last drops from his wineskin. They faced one another, doing their best to ignore the Corlings stalking about the circle. Roger began to play, and all his doubts and fears fell away as the vibration of the strings became his world. He caressed a melody forth and nodded when he was ready. Eric began to sing. They played thus for some time, falling into a comfortable harmony honed by years of practice and performance. Much later, Eric broke off suddenly, looking around.
What is it?
I don't think a demon has struck the ward since we started.
Roger stopped playing, looking out into the night. It was true, he realized, wondering how he hadn't noticed it before. The wood demons were crouched about the circle, motionless. But as Roger met the eyes of one, it sprang at him. The rest of the creatures shook off their daze and attacked.
It was the music! The music held them back! The fiddle boy!
Roger looked dumbly down at the fiddle and bow still clutched in his hands.
Play it, fool!
But Roger's crippled hand shook. The Corlings backed a step away. Roger was emboldened now. The demons were driven further and further off. They put clawed hands to their heads as if in pain. But they did not flee. The demons backed away from the circle slowly until they found a tolerable distance. There they waited, black eyes reflecting the firelight. The sight chilled Roger's heart. They knew he couldn't play forever. Eric had not been exaggerating when he said they would be treated as heroes in the hamlets. The people of Cricket Run had no jongleurs of their own, and many remembered Eric from his time as the Duke's Herald a decade gone. There was a small inn for housing cattle drivers and produce farmers heading to and from Woodsend and Shepherd's Dale, and they were welcomed there and given free room and board. The whole town showed up to watch them perform, drinking enough ale to more than repay the innkeep. In fact, everything went flawlessly, until it came time to pass the hat.
An ear of corn? What are we supposed to do with that?
We could always eat it.
Roger had liked Cricket Run. The people there were simple and good-hearted, and knew how to enjoy life. In Angiers, crowds pressed close to hear his fiddle, nodding and clapping, but he had never seen folk so quick to dance as the runners. Before his fiddle was halfway from its case, they were backing up, making room. Before long, they were reeling and spinning and laughing uproariously, embracing his music fully and flowing wherever it took them. They cried without shame at Eric's sad ballads and laughed hysterically at their bawdy jokes and mummery. They were, in Roger's estimation, everything one could ask in an audience. When the act was over, chants of sweet song and half grip were deafening. They were inundated with offers of lodging, and the wine and food overflowed. Roger was swept behind a haystack by a pair of raven-eyed runner girls, sharing kisses until his head spun. Eric was less pleased.
How could I have forgotten what it was like?
He was referring, of course, to the collection hat. There was no coin in the hamlets, or little enough. What there was went for necessities. Seed and tools and ward posts. A pair of wooden clats settled to the bottom of the hat, but that wasn't even enough to pay for the wine Eric had drunk on the journey from Angiers. For the most part, the runners paid in grain, with the occasional bag of salt or spice thrown in.
Barter! No vintner in Angiers will take payment in bags of barley.
The runners had paid in more than just grain. They gave gifts of salted meat and fresh bread, a horn of clotted cream, and a basket of fruit. Warm quilts, fresh patches for their boots. Whatever goods or services they could spare was offered with gratitude. Roger hadn't eaten so well since the Duke's palace, and for the life of him, he could not understand his master's distress. What was coin for, if not to buy the very things that the runners gave in abundance?
At least they had wine.
Roger eyed the skin nervously as his master took a pull, knowing it would only amplify Eric's distress. But he said nothing. No amount of wine could distress Eric so much as the suggestion that he should not drink so much wine.
I liked it there. I wish we could have stayed longer.
What do you know? You're just a stupid boy. Woodsend will be no better. And Sheepshaggers Dale will be worst of all. What was I thinking, keeping this stupid circle?
No!
Sunset was mere moments away. Roger darted over to the spot and frantically corrected the damage, glancing fearfully at the horizon. He finished not a moment too soon. The Corlings rose as he was still smoothing the rope. He fell back as the first Corling leapt at him.
Ah! Damn you!
The drunken jungler stuck his chin out in defiance.
Master! Please!
Now, have Crippler's breast now? Poor drunk sweet song doesn't know to keep away from calling claws?
It's not like that.
Then what's it like? You think that cause the crowds cheer your name that you'd be anything without me?
No!
Damn right.
Roger's throat tightened, and he reached into his secret pocket for his talisman. He rubbed the smooth wood and silky hair with his thumb, trying to call upon its power.
That's right! Call your mom! Forget who raised you, who taught you everything you know! I gave up my life for you!
Roger gripped his talisman tighter, feeling his mother's presence.
Callie!
He thought again of how Eric had shoved her to the ground, and an angry lump formed in his throat.
No! You were the only one who didn't.
Eric scowled and advanced on the boy.
Give me that!
It's mine!
They struggled for a moment, but Eric was larger and stronger and had two full hands. He snatched the talisman away at last and threw it into the fire.
No!
Roger dove towards the flames, but it was too late. The red hair ignited immediately, and before he could find a twig to fish the talisman out, the wood caught. Roger knelt in the dirt and watched it burn, dumbfounded. His hands began to shake. Eric ignored him, stumbling up to a wood demon that was hunched at the circle's edge, clawing at the wards.
It's your fault this happened to me! Your fault I was saddled with an ungrateful boy and lost my commission! Yours!
Eric smashed his wineskin over the creature's head. The skin burst, spraying them both with blood-red wine and tanned leather.
My wine!
Eric moved to cross the wards as if he could in some way undo the damage.
Master, no!
Roger dove into a tumble, reaching up with his good hand to grab Eric's ratty ponytail as he kicked at the backs of his master's knee. Eric was yanked back away from the wards and landed heavily on top of his apprentice.
Get your hands off of me!
Eric gripped the boy's shirt as he lurched to his feet, shoving him right out of the circle. Corling and human alike froze in that moment. Awareness dawned on Eric's face, even as a wood demon tamped down, launching itself to the board. Roger fell back, having no hope of getting back across the wards in time. He brought up his hands in a feeble attempt to fend the creature off. But before the Corling struck, Eric tackled the demon, knocking it away.
Get back in the circle!
The demon struck back hard, launching the jongleur through the air. He bounced as he hit the ground, a flailing limb snagging the rope of the portable circle and pulling the plates out of alignment. All around the clearing, other Corlings began to race to the breach. They were both going to die, Roger realized. The first demon made to charge at him again, but again Eric grabbed at it, turning it aside.
Your fiddle! You can drive them back!
The Corling's talons dug deep into his chest, and he spit a thick bubble of blood.
Master!
Save yourself!
And with that, the demon tore out his throat. By the time dawn banished the demons back to the core, the fingers of Roger's good hand were cut and bleeding. It was only with great effort that he straightened them and released the fiddle. He had played through the long night, cowering in the darkness as the fire died, sending discordant notes into the air to keep at bay the Corlings he knew were waiting in the black. There had been no beauty, no melody to fall into as he played, just screeches and dissonance. Nothing to turn his thoughts from the horror around him. But now, looking at the scattered bits of flesh and bloody cloth that were all that remained of his master, a new horror struck, and he fell to his knees. After a time, his heaving eased, and he stared at his cramped and bloody hands, willing them to stop shaking. He felt flushed and hot, but his face was cold in the morning air, drained of blood. His stomach continued to roil, but there was nothing left in it to expel. He wiped his mouth with a motley sleeve and forced himself to rise. He tried to collect enough of Eric to bear it, but there was little to be found. A clump of hair. A boot, torn open to get at the meat within. Blood. Corlings disdained neither bone nor offal, and they had fed in a frenzy. The tenders taught that Corlings ate their victim's body and soul, but Eric had always said holy men were bigger liars than jongleurs, and his master could spin a whopper. Roger thought of his talisman and the feeling of his mother's spirit it brought. How could he feel her if her soul had been consumed? He looked to the cold ashes of the fire. The little doll was there, blackened and split, but it crumbled away in his hands. Not far away, lying in the dust, were remains of Eric's ponytail. Roger took the hair, more gray than gold now, and put it in his pocket. He would make a new talisman. Wood's End came into sight well before dusk, much to Roger's relief. He didn't think he had the strength to last another night outside. He had thought of turning back to Cricket Run and begging passage with a messenger back to Angiers, but it would have meant explaining what happened, and Roger wasn't ready for that. Besides, what was there for him in Angiers? Without a license, he couldn't perform, and Eric had made enemies of any that might have completed his apprenticeship. Better to keep on to the ends of the world, where no one would know him and the guild could not reach. Like Cricket Run, Woodsend was filled with good solid folk who welcomed the jongleur with open arms, too pleased to question the fortune that had brought an entertainer to their town. Roger accepted their hospitality with gratitude. He felt a fraud, claiming to be a jongleur when he was only an unlicensed apprentice, but he doubted the Enders would care much if they knew. Would they refuse to dance to his fiddle, or laugh less at his mummery? But Roger didn't dare touch the colored balls in the bag of marvels and begged off from song. He flipped instead, tumbling and hand-walking, using everything in his repertoire to hide his inadequacies. The Enders didn't press him, and that was enough for now. The bright sun brought Arlen back to consciousness. Sand stuck to his face as he lifted his head and spit grit from his mouth. Struggling to his knees, he looked around, but all he saw was sand. They had carried him out onto the dunes and left him to die.
Cowards! Letting the desert do your work does not absolve you!
He quivered on his knees, trying to find the strength to stand while his body screamed at him to lie back down and die. His head was spinning. He had come to help the Krasians. How could they betray him like this?
Don't lie to yourself. You've done your share of betrayal. You ran from your father when he needed you most. Abandoned Cobb before your apprenticeship was up. Left Reagan and Alyssa without so much as an embrace. And Mary...
Who will miss you, Barkin? You will not fill so much as a single tear bottle.
And he was right. If he were to die here, Arlen knew, the only ones who were likely to notice would be merchants more concerned with a loss of profit than his life. Perhaps this was what he deserved for abandoning everyone who had ever loved him. Perhaps he should just lie down and die. A few feet away, a skin of water rested in the sand. Had Jardir's conscience gotten the better of him? Or had one of his men looked back and taken pity on the betrayed messenger? Arlen crawled to the skin, clutching it like a lifeline. Someone might mourn him after all, but it made little difference. Even if he returned to Krasia, no one would believe a kin over the Shurum Ka. On Jardir's word, the Dal Shurum would kill Arlen without a thought.
So you should let them keep the spear you risked your life for? Let them keep Dawnrunner, your portable circles and everything else you own?
The thought had Arlen clutching at his waist, and he realized with relief that he had not lost everything. There, still safe, was the simple leather bag he had carried when fighting in the maze. In it, he kept a small warding kit, his herb pouch, and his notebook. The notebook changed everything. Arlen had lost his other books, but all of them together were not worth this one. Since the day he left Milne, Arlen had copied every new ward he learned into his notebook, including those on the spear.
Let them keep the ripping thing they wanted so much. I can make another.
Arlen brought himself to his feet. He took the warm skin of water and allowed himself a short pull, then put it over his shoulder and climbed to the top of the nearest dune. Shielding his eyes, he could see Krasia like a mirage in the distance, giving him bearings to head for the Oasis of Dawn. Without his horse, the trip would mean a week of sleeping unwarded in the desert. His water would be gone long before then, but he doubted it would matter. The sand demons would get him before he died of thirst. Arlen chewed hog root as he walked. It was bitter and made his stomach churn, but he was covered in demon scratches and it helped keep them from infecting. Besides, without food, even nausea was preferable to pangs of hunger. He drank sparingly, though his throat was dry and swollen. His shirt was tied around his head to ward off the sun, leaving his back vulnerable. His skin was blotched yellow and blue from the beating he had taken, and burned red on top of that. Every step was agony. Arlen kept moving until the sun was nearly set. He felt as if he had made no progress at all, but the long line of tracks blowing away behind him showed a surprising distance covered. Night came, bringing quarrelings and bitter cold. Either was enough to kill him, so Arlen hid from both, burying himself in the sand to preserve body heat and hide from the demons. He tore a sheet from his notebook, rolling the paper into a slender breathing tube, but still he felt as if he were suffocating as he lay, terrified that the quarrelings might find him. When the sun rose and warmed the sand, he dug free of his sandy grave and stumbled on, feeling as if he had not rested at all. So it went, day after day, night after night. He grew weaker as the days went by without food, rest, or more than a splash of water. His skin cracked and bled, but he ignored the damage and walked on. The sun beat down with increasing weight, and the flat horizon grew no closer. At some point, he lost his boots. He wasn't sure how or when. His feet were scraped raw from the hot sand, bleeding and blistered. He tore the sleeves from his shirt to bind them. He fell with increasing frequency, sometimes getting right back to his feet, other times passing out and rising minutes or hours later. Sometimes he would fall and continue tumbling all the way down a dune. Exhausted, he took it as a blessing, saving himself painful steps. By the time the water ran out, he had lost count of the days. He was still on the desert path, but he had no idea how far there was yet to go. His lips were split and dry, and even his cuts and blisters had ceased to ooze, as if all the liquid in his body had evaporated. He fell over again and struggled to find a reason to get back up. Arlen awoke, his face wet. It was nighttime, and that should have filled him with terror, but he lacked the strength to fear. He looked down and saw that his face had been resting on the edge of the pool in the Oasis of Dawn, his hand in the water. He wondered how he had gotten to be there. His last memory. He had no idea what his last memory was. The trip through the desert was a blur, but he didn't care. He had made it. That was all that mattered. Within the warded obelisks of the Oasis, he was safe. Arlen drank greedily from the pool. When his thirst was quenched, he closed his eyes again and slept soundly for the first time in over a week. When he woke, Arlen raided the Oasis stores. There were supplies as well as food, blankets, herbs, a spare warding kit. Too weak to forage, he spent several days simply eating the dried stores, drinking cool water, and cleansing his wounds. By then, he was able to gather fresh fruit. After a week, he found the strength to fish. Two, he could stand and stretch without pain. The Oasis had stores enough to get him out of the desert. He might be half dead when he crawled from the scorched clay flats, but he would be half alive as well. He found a handful of spears in the Oasis as well, but compared to the magnificent metal weapon he had lost, sharpened wood seemed woefully inadequate. Without lacquer to harden the symbols, carved wards would mar with the first thrust through hard coiling scales. What then? He had wards that could burn the life from demons, but what good were they without a weapon to affix them to? He considered painting stones with the attack wards. He could throw them, or even press them against the coralings by hand. If he was going to get that close to a demon, he might as well paint the wards right onto his hands. Suddenly, the thought germinated. Could it work? If so, he would have a weapon no one could steal, one no coraling could knock from his grasp or catch him without. Arlen took out his notebook, studying the wards on the spear's tip and those at its butt. Those were the offensive wards. The wards on the shaft were defensive. He noted that the wards on the butt did not form a line by linking with others, as did the wards along the edge of the tip. They stood alone, the same symbol repeated around the circumference of the spear and on the flat of its end. Perhaps the difference was one of cutting versus bludgeoning. As the sun dipped lower, Arlen copied the bludgeoning ward in the sand over and over until he felt confident. He took a brush and a paint bowl from his warding kit, carefully painting the ward onto the palm of his left hand. Painting his right hand was trickier, but Arlen knew from experience that with concentration, he could ward equally well with his left hand, though it took longer. As darkness descended, Arlen gently flexed his hands, making sure the movement would not crack or peel the paint. Satisfied, he went to the stone obelisk that warded the oasis, watching the demons circle the barrier, smelling prey just beyond their reach. The first Corling to catch sight of him was a specimen of no particular note, a sand demon about 4 feet in length, with long arms and bunched muscular legs. Its barbed tail slithered back and forth as it met Arlen's eyes. A moment later, it launched itself at the warden. As it leapt, Arlen stepped aside and reached out, partially covering two wards. The net broke, and the Corling tumbled past him, confused at the lack of resistance. He quickly drew his hand back, re-establishing the net. Whatever happened, the demon would not survive. The demon righted itself and turned back. It circled, its corded muscles tensing as its tail flicked sharply. Then, it pounced again. Arlen met it head-on, holding his hands with palms out, his arms longer than the demon. The creature's scaled chest struck the wards, and with a flash, the Corling was thrown back. It struck the ground hard, and Arlen could see thin wisps of smoke rising from the point of contact. The demon got back to its feet and began circling again, this time more cautiously. It was unaccustomed to prey fighting back, but it soon regained its courage, leaping to the attack again. Arlen caught the Corling's wrists and fell back. As he made contact, the wards flared, and he could feel the magic working. It did not burn him, though the Corling's flesh sizzled at the touch. But there was a tingle of energy in his hands, as if they had lost circulation and gone prickly. The feeling shot up his arms like a shiver. They both rose quickly. The demon licked at his scorched wrists, trying to soothe them, and Arlen could see grudging respect in its eyes. Respect and fear. This time, he was the predator. His confidence was almost the death of him. The demon lunged, and this time, Arlen was too slow. Black talons raked across his chest as he tried to twist out of the way. He punched out in desperation, forgetting that the wards were on his palm. His knuckles scraped against the Corling's gritty scales, tearing skin, but the blow had little effect. With a backhanded swat, the sand demon sent him sprawling to the ground. The next moments were desperate, as Arlen scrambled and rolled to avoid its slashing claws, razor teeth, and whipping spiked tail. He started to rise, but the demon coiled and pounced on him. Arlen bared his own teeth as he boxed the demon's ears. The wards flared, but Arlen held on tightly. Every moment he held on, the tingling in his palms grew in intensity as if gaining momentum. He squeezed his hands together and was amazed when they grew closer, as if the creature's skull was softening, liquefying. In that moment, Arlen knew there could never be peace between him and the Corlings. He knew in his heart he could never sit safe behind his wards and let them dance in peace now that he had another choice. But who would stand by his side and fight? Jeff had struck him at the idea. Alyssa had scolded him. Mary had shunned him. The Krasians had tried to kill him. Ever since the night he had seen Jeff watch his wife be cored from the safety of his porch wards, Arlen had known that the Corling's greatest weapon was fear. What he hadn't understood was that fear took many forms. For all his attempts to prove otherwise, Arlen was terrified of being alone. He wanted someone, anyone, to believe in what he was doing. Someone to fight with and for. But there was no one. He saw that now. If he wanted companionship, he would have to slink back to the cities and accept it on their terms. If he wanted to fight, he had to do it alone. the sense of power and elation so fresh in his mind, faded. He curled up slowly, gripping his knees, and stared out over the desert, looking for a road where there was none. Arlen rose with the sun and padded to the pool to rince his wounds. He had stitched and poulticed them before bedding down, but one could never be too careful with wounds from a coraline. As he splashed the cool water on his face, his tattoo caught his eye. All messengers had tattoos, marking their city of origin. It was a symbol of how far they had traveled. Arlen remembered that first day when Reagan showed him his, the city and the mountains that graced the flag of Milne. Arlen had meant to get that same tattoo when he completed his first job. He went to a tattooist, ready to be marked forever a messenger, but he had hesitated. Fort Milne was home to him in many ways, but it was not where he had come from. Tibbet's Brook had no flag, so Arlen took the crest of Earl Tibbet himself, lush fields split by a stream that fed a small lake. The tattooist took his needles and imprinted that reminder of home on Arlen's shoulder for all time. The notion lingered in Arlen's mind. He had watched that tattooist closely. The man's art was not so different from that of a warder. Precise markings, painstakingly placed with no room for error. There were needles in Arlen's herb pouch and ink in his warding kit. Arlen started a small fire, recalling every moment spent with the tattooist. He passed his needles through the flames, pouring a bit of thick, viscous ink into a small bowl. He wrapped thread about the needles to prevent them from piercing too deeply and carefully studied the contours of his left hand, noticing every wrinkle and shift as it flexed. When he was ready, he took a needle, dipped it in the ink, and set to work. It was slow going. He was forced to pause frequently to wipe his palm clear of blood and excess ink. He had nothing but time, though, so he worked with care, his hand steady. By mid-morning, he was satisfied with his warding. He poulticed the hand and wrapped it carefully, then went about replenishing the oasis stores. He worked hard the rest of the day and the day after that, knowing that he would need as much as he could carry before he left. Arlen remained in the oasis for another week, warding his skin in the mornings and gathering food in the afternoons. The tattoos on his palms healed rapidly, but Arlen did not stop there. Remembering the skinned knuckles from punching the sand demon, he warded those of his left hand, waiting only for the scabs on his right to fall away before he did those as well. No coraline would ever shrug away one of his punches again. As he worked, he ran through his battle with the sand demon repeatedly, remembering how it moved, its strength and speed, the nature of its attacks, and the signals that heralded them. He made careful notes of his recollections, studying them and considering how his reactions could have been better. He could not afford to stumble anymore. The Krasians had honed the brutal yet precise moves of Sherusak into an art form. He began to adapt the moves and the placement of his tattoos so the two would act as one. When Arlen finally left the Oasis of Dawn, he ignored the path entirely, cutting straight across the sand towards the lost city of Anak Sun. He took as much dried food as he could carry. Anak Sun had a well, but no food, and he planned to be there for some time. Even as he left, Arlen knew that his water would not last all the way to the lost city. Spare skins at the oasis were few, and it might take as much as 2 weeks to reach the city on foot. His water wouldn't last a week, but never once did he look back.
There's nothing behind me. I can only go forward.
As dusk spread darkness across the sand, Arlen continued on, not bothering to set camp. The stars were clear over the cloudless desert, and it was easy to keep his sense of direction. Easier, in fact, than it was during the day. There were few corlings so far out in the desert. They tended to congregate where there was prey, and prey was scarce on the barren sands. Arlen walked for hours in the cold moonlight before a demon caught his scent. Arlen did not flee, for he knew it could track him, nor did he try to hide, for he had much further to go that night. He stood his ground as the sand demon came bounding over the dunes. When Arlen met the creature's gaze calmly, the corling paused, confused. Arlen only smiled. Arlen did not react at all. Instead, he focused on his surroundings. Sand demons hunted in packs. Arlen had never seen one of them alone before, and he doubted this one was now. Sure enough, while his attention had been fixed upon the snarling, shrieking creature before him, two more demons, as silent as death, had circled around to either side, nearly invisible in the darkness. Arlen pretended not to notice them, keeping eye contact with the corling in front of him as it drew closer and closer. The attack came, as expected, not from the posturing sand demon before him, but from those off to the sides. As the two sand demons leapt at him from either side, four talons reaching, he darted forward towards the demon that had been serving as the distraction. Yeah! chaos, the two attacking demons veered off, barely avoiding a collision, while the other backed away in surprise. It was fast, but not as fast as Arlen's left hook. The wards on his knuckles flared, a sizzling blow that rocked the demon back on its heels. But Arlen did not stop there. He snapped his right hand onto the Quarling's face, pressing the ward tattooed on his palm against its eyes. The ward activated, burning, and the creature lashed out blindly. Anticipating the move, Arlen threw himself backwards. He came back up a few feet away from the blinded creature, facing the other two Quarlings as they launched themselves his way. As the first reached for him, he stepped right up inside its grasp and boxed its ears. The explosion of magic collapsed the demon to the sand, where it writhed in agony, clutching at its head. The second demon was close behind the first, and Arlen had no time to dodge or strike. Instead, remembering another trick from the last encounter, he caught the creature's wrists and threw himself onto his back, kicking upwards. Before the thrown demon could recover, Arlen pounced on the one writhing on the ground. Digging his knees into its back and ignoring the pain as its scales cut into it. He caught the Quarling about the throat with one hand and pressed the other hard into the back of its head. He felt the magic beginning to build, but was forced to relinquish his hold too soon in order to roll out of the way as the Quarling he had thrown renewed its assault. Arlen came back to his feet, and he and the Sand Demon circled one another warily. It charged, and Arlen bent his knees, ready to sidestep the slashing claws. But the demon stopped short, snapping its stout, powerful frame about like a whip. Its thick tail collided with Arlen's side, sending him sprawling. As the Sand Demon retracted its tail for another strike, Arlen managed to grasp it. He squeezed, feeling the ward tingle in his palm. It grew warm as the magic gathered, finally burning right through the tail, popping the ridged end off in Icarus splatter. Arlen was thrown back by the severance, and the Quarling, free again, whirled on him and attacked. Arlen caught one of its wrists in his left hand and jabbed his right elbow into the creature's throat. But the unwarded blow had little effect. The demon flexed its sinewy arms, and Arlen again found himself flying through the air. As the creature pounced, Arlen called upon his last reserves of strength and met it head on, locking his hands around its throat and bearing it backwards. They struck the ground hard, and Arlen brought his knees up to the Quarling's arm joints, pinning the limbs with his weight as he continued to choke, feeling the magic swell with every passing second. He rose from the now headless demon and looked to the others. The one whose ears he had boxed was crawling weakly away, its will for the fight gone. The blind demon had vanished, but Arlen was untroubled by that fact. He didn't envy the crippled creature its trip back to the core. Likely, its fellows would tear it to pieces. He finished off the demon limping pathetically in the sand, bandaged his wounds, and then, after a short rest, picked up his roll of provisions and headed on towards Anak's Sun. Arlen traveled night and day, taking his sleep in the shadow of the dunes when the sun was highest. On only two other nights was he forced to fight, once against another pack of sand demons, and once against a lone wind demon. The others he passed unmolested. Without the weight of the sun upon him, he covered more distance by night than by day. He was windburned and raw by his seventh day out of the oasis, his feet blistered and bleeding, and his water gone. But new strength flowed into him as Anak's Sun came into view. Arlen refilled his skins at one of the few working wells, drinking deeply, and then set to warding the building that led into the catacombs where he had found the spear. For the next week, Arlen explored the catacombs, carefully copying new wards wherever he found them. He found more of the stone coffins, but none contained weapons like the first one he found. Still, there was an abundance of wards etched upon the coffins and pillars, and more were painted into stories upon the walls. Arlen could not read the pictograms, but he understood much from the body language and expressions on the sequential images. The works were so intricate that he could make out some of the wards on the weapons the warriors carried. There were new breeds of Quarlings in the pictures as well. A series of images showed men killed by demons that looked human, save for their teeth and claws. One central image showed a thin Quarling with spindly limbs and a scrawny chest, its head enormous for its body, standing before a host of demons. The Quarling faced off against a robed man who stood before a like number of human warriors. The faces of the two were contorted as if in a contest of wills, but they stood well apart. A halo of light surrounded them as their respective armies looked on. Perhaps most striking about the image, the man held no weapon. The light emanating from him seemed to be from a ward painted, tattooed, upon his forehead. Harlan looked to the next image and saw the demon and its host flee as the humans raised their spears in triumph. Harlan copied the ward from the man's forehead carefully into his notebook. Days passed and food dwindled. If he stayed in Anak Sun any longer, he would starve before he found more. He decided to leave at first light for Fort Risen. Once he reached the city, he could secure a banknote against his accounts to cover a horse and supplies to return. But it galled him to leave having barely scratched the surface of Anak Sun. Many tunnels had collapsed, requiring time to dig through, and there were many more buildings that might have entrances to underground chambers. The ruins held the key to destroying demonkind, and this was the second time his stomach had forced him to abandon them. The Corallings rose while he was lost in thought. They came in numbers to Anak Sun, despite the lack of prey. Perhaps they thought the buildings might one day attract more men, or perhaps they took pleasure in dominating a place that had once stood in defiance of their kind. Harlan rose and walked to the edge of his wards, watching the Corallings dance in the moonlight. His stomach rumbled, and he wondered, not for the first time, at the nature of demons. They were magical creatures, seemingly immortal and inhuman. They destroyed, but they did not create. Even their corpses burned away instead of rotting to feed the soil. But he had seen them feed, seen them shit and piss. Was their nature entirely outside the natural order?
What are you?
The creature only swiped at the wards, growling in frustration and stalking away when they flared. Harlan watched it go, his thoughts dark.
To the core with it.
Harlan leapt out from the protection of his wards. The Corling turned just in time to take a blow from Arlen's warded knuckle. Before it knew what had hit it, the demon was dead. Other Corlings approached at the sound, but they moved warily. But Arlen was able to dart back to the building and cover his wards long enough to drag his victim through.
Let's see if you can't give something back after all.
Using cutting wards painted onto a sharp piece of obsidian, he opened up the sand demon, surprised to find that beneath the hard armor, its flesh was as vulnerable as his. The muscle and sinew was tough, but not so much more than that of any beast. The stench of the creature was terrible. The black ichor that served as its blood stank so badly that Arlen's eyes teared. Holding his breath, he cut meat from the creature and shook it vigorously to remove the excess fluid before setting it over his small fire. After the ichor smoked and eventually burned away, the smell of the cooking flesh became tolerable. When it was cooked through, Harlan held up the dark, foul meat, and the years melted away, casting him back to Tippett's Brook and the words of Colleen Trigg. He had caught a fish that day, but its scales were brown and sickly, and the herb gatherer had made him throw it back.
Never eat something that looks sick. What you put in your mouth becomes a part of you.
Will this become a part of me too?
He looked at the meat, mustered his nerve, and put it in his mouth.
Of all the luck.
The rain increased to a steady pour, and Roger picked up his pace. He had been planning to leave Shepherd's Dale for some time, but hadn't expected it to be under such hurried and unpleasant circumstances. He supposed he couldn't blame the shepherd. True, the man spent more time tending to his flock than his wife, and it was she who made the advance. But coming home early to beat the rain and finding a boy in bed with your wife didn't tend to put men in a reasoning mood. In a way, he was thankful for the rain. Without it, the man might well have raised half the men in the Dale to give chase. Dalesmen were a possessive lot, probably because their women were often left alone while they took their precious herds to graze. The shepherds were serious folk about their herds and about their wives. Interfere with either one. After a frantic chase around the room, the shepherd's wife had jumped upon her husband's back, restraining him long enough for Roger to snatch up his bags and dart out the door. Roger's bags were always packed. Eric had taught him that.
Night.
He drew his motley cloak tighter, wondering why he always seemed to be running from something. Over the last 2 years, he had moved on almost every season, living in Cricket Run, Wood's End, and Shepherd's Dale 3 times each, at least, but he still felt like an outsider. Most villagers went their whole lives without ever leaving their town, and were forever attempting to persuade Roger to do the same.
Marry me! Marry my daughter! Stay at my inn and we'll paint your name over the door to attract customers! Keep me warm while my husband's afield. Help us harvest and stay the winter.
They said it 100 ways, but they all meant give up the road and plant roots here. Every time it was said, Roger found himself on the road. It was nice to be wanted, but as what? A husband? A father? A farmhand? Roger was a jongleur, and he could not imagine being anything else. The first time he lifted a finger at harvest or helped chase down a lost sheep, he knew he would be starting down a road that would quickly make him otherwise. He touched the golden-haired talisman in its secret pocket, feeling Eric's spirit watching over him. True to Eric's words, the Hamlets had sharpened Roger's skills. 2 years of constant performing had made him into more than just a fiddler and tumbler. Without Eric to lead, Roger had been forced to broaden and grow, coming up with innovative ways to entertain alone. He was constantly perfecting some new magic trick or bit of music. But as much as his tricks and fiddling, what he had become known for was his storytelling. Everyone in the Hamlets loved a good story, especially one that told of faraway places. Roger obliged, telling of places he'd seen and places he hadn't, towns that sat over the next hill, and ones that existed only in his imagination. The stories grew bigger with every telling, his characters coming alive in people's minds as they went on their adventures. Jack Scaletongue, who could speak to Corlings and was forever tricking the stupid beasts with false promises. Marco Rover, who crossed the Milnese Mountains and found a rich land on the other side where Corlings were worshipped like gods. And of course, the Warded Man. The Duke's jongleurs passed through the Hamlets to make decrees every spring, and the latest had told tales of a feral man who had wandered the wilderness, killing demons and feasting on their flesh. He claimed it was honest word from a tattooist who had put wards on the man's back, and that others had confirmed the tale. The audience's attention had been rapt, and when folks had asked Roger to retell the story another night, he had obliged, adding embellishments all his own. Listeners loved to ask questions and attempt to catch him in contradiction. But Roger delighted in the dance of words, keeping the bumpkins convinced of his outlandish tales. Ironically, the most difficult boast to sell was that he could make the Corlings dance with his fiddle. He could have proved it at any time, of course. But as Eric used to say,
the moment you get up to prove one thing, you'll be expected to prove them all.
Roger looked up at the sky.
I'll be playing for the Corlings soon enough.
In the cities, where high walls made it so that most people never saw an actual Corling, it was believed to be a tapweed tale that they could rise under dark clouds. But living outside the walls in the Hamlets for 2 years had taught Roger better. Most would wait until full sunset to rise, but if the clouds grew thick enough, a few bold demons would test the false knight. Cold and wet, and in no mood to take the risk, he cast about for a suitable campsite. He'd be lucky to make Wood's End the next day. More likely, he would be 2 nights on the road. The thought made his stomach churn. And Wood's End would be no better than the Dale, or Cricket Run for that matter. Sooner or later, he would get some woman with child, or worse, fall in love, and before he knew it, he would only be taking his fiddle from its case on festival days. Until he needed to barter it to fix the plow or to buy seed. Then he would be just like everyone else.
Or you could go home.
Roger often thought of returning to Angiers, but was forever coming up with reasons to put it off another season. After all, what did the city have to offer? Narrow streets, choked with people and animals, wooden planks infused with the stench of manure and garbage, beggars and thieves, and the ever-present worry about money. People who ignored each other as an art.
Normal people.
Villagers were always seeking to know everything about their neighbors and opened their homes to strangers without a thought. It was commendable, but Roger was a city boy at heart. Returning to Angiers would mean dealing with the guild again. An unlicensed jongleur's days were numbered, but a guildsman in good standing's business was assured. His experience in the Hamlets should be enough to win him a license, especially if he found a guildsman to speak for him. Eric had alienated most of those, but Roger might find one to take pity on him upon hearing of his master's fate. He found a tree that gave some shelter from the rain, and after setting up his circle, managed to collect enough dry tinder from beneath its boughs to start a small fire. He fed it carefully, but the wind and wet extinguished it before long.
Bugger the Hamlets!
Darkness enveloped Roger, broken only by the occasional flare of magic as a demon tested his wards.
Bugger them all!
Angiers hadn't changed much since he'd been gone. It seemed smaller, but Roger had been living in wide open places for some time and had grown a few inches since he had been there last. He was 16 now, a man by anyone's standards. He stood outside the city for some time, staring at the gate, wondering if he was making a mistake. He had a little coin, sifted carefully from his collection hat over the years and hoarded against his return, and some food in his pack. It wasn't much, but it would keep him out of the shelters for a few nights at least.
If all I want is a full belly and a roof, I can always go back to the Hamlets.
He found an inn that was cheap enough and unpacked his best motley, heading back out as soon as he was changed. The Jongleur's Guildhouse was located near the center of town, where its residents could easily make engagements in any part of the city. Any licensed jongleur could live in the house, provided they took the jobs assigned to them without complaint and paid half their earnings to the guild.
Fools! Any jongleur willing to give half his take for a roof and three communal servants and gruel isn't worthy of the name.
It was true enough. Only the oldest and least skilled jongleurs lived in the house, ready to take the jobs others turned down. Still, it was better than destitution and safer than public shelters. The wards on the guildhouse were strong, and its residents less apt to rob one another. Roger headed for the residences, and a few inquiries soon had him knocking on a particular door.
Hey, who's that?
Roger Halfgrip, sir. I was apprenticed to Eric Sweetsong.
The confused look soured in an instant, and the man moved to close the door.
Master Jacob, please.
The old man made no effort to close the door as he moved back into the small chamber and sat down heavily. Roger entered, closing the door behind them.
What is it that you want? I am an old man and I don't have time for games.
I need a sponsor to apply for a guild license.
Oh, Eric's become a dead weight? He's drinking, slowing down your success, so you're leaving him to rot and striking out on your own? That's fitting. It's what he did to me 25 years ago. But fitting or no, if you think I'm to help in your betrayal...
Master Jacob, Eric is dead. Cord on the road to Woodsend, 2 years gone.
Keep your back straight, boy.
Jacob spoke as they walked down the hall.
Remember to look the guildmaster in the eye, and don't speak until you're spoken to.
Jacob had already said these things a dozen times, but Roger only nodded. He was young to get his own license, but Jacob said there had been some in the guild's history who were younger still. It was talent and skill that would win a license, not years. It wasn't easy to get an appointment with the guildmaster, even with a sponsor. Jacob hadn't had the strength to perform in years. And while the guildsmen were politely respectful of his advanced years, he was more ignored than venerated in the office wing of the guildhouse. The guildmaster's secretary left them waiting outside his office for several hours, watching in despair as other appointments came and went.
Guildmaster Charles will see you now.
The guildmaster's office was like nothing Roger had seen since his time in the Duke's palace. Thick, warm carpet covered the floors, patterned and bright. And elaborate oil lamps with colored glass hung from the oak walls between paintings of great battles, beautiful women, and still lives. His desk was dark polished walnut with small intricate statuettes for paperweights, mirroring the larger statues on pedestals throughout the room. Behind the desk was the symbol of the Jongleur's Guild, three colored balls in a large seal on the wall.
I don't have a lot of time, Master Jacob.
Guildmaster Charles didn't even bother to look up from the sheaf of papers on his desk. He was a heavy man, 50 summers at least, dressed in the embroidered cloth of a merchant or noble, rather than Jongleur's motley.
Oh, this one is worth your time. The apprentice of Eric Sweetsong.
Didn't realize you and Eric were still in touch. Heard you broke on bad terms.
The years have a way of softening such things. I've made my peace with Eric.
It seems you're the only one. Most of the men in this building would as soon throttle the man as look at him.
They'd be a little late. Eric is dead.
I'm saddened to hear that. Every one of us is precious. Was it the drink, in the end?
Quarrelings.
When? And where?
2 years, on the road to Woodsend.
I recall his apprentice was something of a fiddler.
Oh, indeed, that and more. I present to you Roger Halfgrip.
Roger bowed.
Halfgrip? I've heard tales of a Halfgrip playing the Western Hamlets. That you, boy?
Roger's eyes widened, but he nodded. Eric had said that reputations carry quickly from the Hamlets, but it was still a shock. He wondered if his reputation was good or ill.
Don't let it go to your head. Yokels exaggerate.
Yes, sir, I understand.
Well then, Let's get on with this. Show me what you have.
Here?
You performed with Eric for years, so I'll accept that you can juggle and sing. Earning a license means showing a focus skill beyond those basics.
Fiddling boy, just like you did me.
Roger nodded. His hand shook slightly as he took his fiddle from its case, but when his fingers closed about the smooth wood, the fear washed away like dust in a bath. He began to play, the guildmaster forgotten as he fell into the music.
No, I will not wait for some worthless apprentice to finish his test. Move aside!
Master Jason stormed into the room.
I'm sorry, Guildmaster. He refused to wait.
Charles waved the clerk away as Jason stormed up to him.
You gave the Duke's ball to Adam? That's been my performance for 10 years. My uncle will hear of this.
The Duke himself requested the change. If your uncle has a problem, suggest he take it up with his grace.
Jason scowled. Everyone else in Angiers might know that First Minister Jansen was the true power in the city, but Duke Rhinebeck did not, and it was doubtful even Jansen would change that over a performance for his nephew.
If that's all you came to discuss, Jason, you'll have to excuse us. Young Roger here is testing for his license.
Jason's eyes snapped over to Roger, flaring with recognition.
Ah, I see you've ditched the drunk. Hope you didn't trade him in for this old relic.
Jason thrust his chin at Jacob.
The offer stands. You want to work for me. Let Eric beg for your scraps for a change, eh?
Master Eric was caught on the road 2 years ago.
Fantastic. That news makes up for losing the Duke's ball and to spare.
Roger didn't even realize what he'd done until he was standing over the master, his knuckles tingling and wet. Jacob grabbed him and pulled him back as Jason surged to his feet.
I'll kill you for that, you little...
Charles was between them in an instant. Jason thrashed in his grasp, but the guildmaster's bulk was more than enough to restrain him.
That's enough, Jason. You're not killing anyone.
You saw what he did.
And I heard what you said. I was tempted to hit you myself.
How am I supposed to sing tonight?
I'll get someone to perform in your stead. The guild will cover the loss. David?
The clerk stuck his head in the door.
Escort Master Jason to a herb gatherer and have the bill sent here.
David nodded, moving to assist Jason. The master shoved him away.
This isn't over!
Well, boy, you've gone and done it now. That's an enemy I wouldn't wish on anyone.
He was already my enemy. You heard what he said.
I did, but you still should have restrained yourself. What will you do if a patron insults you next? Or the Duke himself? Guildsmen can't go around punching anyone that angers them.
I understand.
You've just cost me a fair bit of coin, though. I'd be throwing money and prime performances at Jason for weeks to keep him and the First Minister appeased. And with that fiddling of yours, I'd be a fool not to make you earn it back.
Roger looked up hopefully.
Probationary license. You're only to perform under the supervision of a master of the guild, paid from your take, and half of your gross earnings will come to this office until I consider your debt closed. Understood?
Oh, absolutely, sir!
And you'll hold your temper, or I'll tear up this license and you'll never perform in Angiers again.